Two speakers are from Dynamo, and they'll be presenting on augmenting your reserving toolkit. Laura van Skalkveld joined Dynamo in 2020 as part of the consulting team. She's a fellow of the Actuarial Society of South Africa and has experience in the capital, reserving, IFRS 17 and pricing, mostly in the South African market. This experience has been a mixture of traditional consulting and actuarial review. Laura is passionate about helping her clients' actuarial teams achieve end-to-end process automation through the use of Dynamo's software cycle. Stefan Murray is experienced in designing and implementing technology solutions for actuarial teams and is passionate about improving and optimizing models. He is currently a senior manager at Dynamo Analytics, actuarial software development team lead, as well as product owner for the software cycle, an actuarial and financial modeling platform which is used for reserving process automation in various markets. Thanks, Stefan and Laura.
Thanks for the intro, Nicola. By show of hands, who does not use Chainladder to set reserves? Great. Topical. Okay, so last year we tried something. So some of you that were here last year, we tried to say, I think the time is right for stuff like individual claims reserving. Perhaps you take a step back. Take more incremental steps. Let's put it that way. Okay. Just introducing the topic. The flow of this, we're going to zoom out. So just look at what the global market's doing in the reserving space a little bit. And then specifically zoom into South Africa. What makes South Africa unique? What it applies to us? What doesn't? What doesn't? What is not so applicable to us? Laura's going to talk a bit about, focus a bit about the practical constraints, just focusing on data. And then we're going to cover a few cool topics. These are methods which you might have seen but not used yet. We're gonna introduce these. Tried our best at introducing them technically, but I guess time is short, so some of it will feel a bit like a skim over. If you have more questions, feel free to speak to us afterwards. Send an email or anything. And then at the end, we're gonna try and zoom out again. Okay, so what we see happening globally in the reserving space is that there's a lot of research innovation. There's a lot of people with various opinions on things and different ways of different opinions on how you need to set your reserves. Should it be stochastic modeling? Should it be just a deterministic model? All these different mindsets are at play. And we just, with the sheer volume of publications in this space, it kind of looks like there's a problem. There seems to be clear limitations of the traditional methods. And yet, there are all these papers that prove, it's performing so much better, it's so much more predictive, this fancy method, this neural net, or this GLM reserving and things like that. Yet we don't see it being employed that much. So what are the constraints? And then the question is, if this is happening globally, how do we navigate this in our market? And what makes our market unique? Okay, so globally, so currently there are various factors influencing reserving processes. So there's an increased need to adapt to change. Emerging trends, new things, external factors, environmental factors. There's a need to have adaptable processes, and adaptable modeling techniques. So there's an increase increased need for reporting frequency, and the level, also the level of sophistication that these models need, like the level of sophistication that they have to be at. So things like extra granular cash flows that has to be reported on, pushed to the ledger, things like that. And then there's also a bit of a competitive push. So in one of the sessions earlier, it was also mentioned that you know, so there's all these things like you know, generative AI and all these technological advances, and it almost feels like if you're not adapting, you're falling behind. Some companies we see are creating these worker bots that can send emails and stuff, and we've seen this on our side, like a bot logging a ticket on a help desk, stuff like that. Then there's also more software as a service products becoming available for actuaries. So actuaries are delving into the data science and machine learning fields, like in the previous session. There's a lot of challenge to traditional modeling mindsets. So actuaries, like especially I think the younger actuaries are more and more challenging the traditional modeling mindset. So they want to think more like a data scientist or like a machine learning engineer or something like that. So we see more of this globally. This one is very interesting for me. There's a requirement on management and governance of big companies to, like, they require us in our processes to be proactive and not reactive. Okay, so we must make our process more robust proactively, okay? And we see this especially like in the UK, in Australia, where corporate governance is really, really a big thing. Okay, then other global trends, global things. So inflation is very topical, and how you adjust for this especially in the UK market. Inflation's come down now again in the US, so it seems to have completed its like up and down cycle. But in various other markets, it's still a big, big, big topic. And how do you adjust for inflation when you set reserves? So this is an extract from a survey on the right, but just the left summarizes it a little bit. So this person comments and says, reserving practices continue to change. We expect it to continue to change. It's influenced by technology, big data, regulatory requirements. There remains a big need to understand uncertainty in models. The time and opportunity to broaden our roles it's now the time to time and opportunity to broaden our roles and evolve reserving techniques. Okay, so can anyone guess, when do you think this statement was published? Feels like today, right? So not much has changed since 2016. So almost 10 years ago. Okay. So this was from the Aston survey in 2016. Some of you might have read this, and this is obviously outdated, okay? But still somewhat relevant. So this is just a summary of the methods used. So main method. Let me just use the laser. Okay. So that's main method. So majority of people set reserves using chain ladder globally, and BF and loss ratio method are the most popular globally. And then in terms of this summarizes that as well. This is South African landscape. Okay, cool. So now zooming into South Africa. Okay, what makes South Africa unique? How do we compare against the global reserving trends and stuff? So in South Africa, there's a higher reliance on chain ladder. But this was as of 2016. I was hoping it's changed, but I don't think it's changed a lot. So loss ratio method is actually not very popular. although it is used as a peer method, and the BF is also quite popular.
Yeah,
I think Cape Cod is increasing. The popularity of Cape Cod is increasing in South Africa, but okay. And in terms of trends, like adjusting for different trends in like bespoke ways, this just summarizes a bit of what we do in South Africa and what we don't do. Summary is that our reserving processes are not very sophisticated or not very niche. And then another thing that makes South Africa unique. So yes, we have the same COVID issues and weather issues, like we've seen KZN riots. We have higher inflation than the first world markets, and we've got load shedding. So so it's quite an interesting topic. I sat here this morning listening to the comments about the energy and the energy minister, and last year we were talking about the risk of blackout. I think it's still a risk, but maybe not everyone agrees. Maybe it's less of a risk now. Okay, so that's what makes South Africa a bit unique in terms of like trends and stuff. And in terms of this is why I think our reserving processes are very basic, and it's because in terms of lines of business, basically we have very little long tail classes. So majority is short tail business, and it's short tail business that is very predictive. They have very predictive payment patterns, very predictive development patterns, and the argument is basically, well, if my class is so predictive, why should I use such a sophisticated method, like a more sophisticated method than with chain ladder and BF and stuff? Right. So cool. So I'm going to invite Laura up to talk about some practical constraints.
Great. Thank you, Stefan, for painting the picture for us and giving us the landscape that we are facing in South Africa. My name is Laura, so I'll be speaking about practical constraints quickly, but we're going to get into the fun part. Can you hear me? We're going to get into the fun part after one slide, so bear with me. Stefan has painted the picture, and we just want to address one practical constraint, which is related to data. Can you hear me fine? So why data specifically? There are many other constraints that we could have spoken about, but we want to focus on data because we've just seen that it's either a great enabler to gain more insights from your reserving process, or it's a hindrance. We want to enable you to get that enabling factor so that you can gain more insights from your reserving processes and your reserving data. So jumping into that, we just want to speak about improving the level of information that you get from the data. So ignoring data quality, data checks, all of those things, we're just zooming in on the level of information. The first point we want to suggest is to find an alternative to bordereau claims data. If we want to gain more insights, get more information about trends in our data, if we have transactional data, which leads me to the next point, we gain more insights, and this is probably a very big practical constraint. I've seen some heads shaking. Probably not the easiest to move away from, but if we can get to a place where we can recognize the insights gained from getting transactional claims data rather than snapshots at a point in time or quarterly positions, we can try and move away from that. And let's say for transactional claims data, you see claims positions at the end of the month, but if you can dive a bit into that, you could see, oh, wow, okay, this date there was a payment transaction. This date there was a case estimate movement. This date there was a correction on data. Similarly, if you have a claim that came in just before the cutoff, and your next reporting period is a quarter later, you definitely distort the patterns if that claim might have been paid 3 days later, for instance. So the next point is just increasing the frequency at which you receive your claim data sets. Ideally, it would be great to have claims data on demand, available on demand, but that's not always practical. So increasing just the frequency at which we receive data sets is already a great step. Doing monthly by monthly triangles to see trends and seasonality effects rather than annual by annual triangles, for example. And then the last two points just relate to additional data and triangles. So as a start, having finalization dates in your data, which isn't common as we've seen. If you know about the payments per active claim method or active numbers concept, you can add activity periods to your data. And the final point that I want to just add, which is for us the quick one, having case estimate triangles and numbers triangles rather than just paid claims and incurred claims triangles. And just a practical note from our side, it's always great to set a roadmap, having goals and timelines to really push yourself to be proactive, as Stefan has also mentioned. Okay, so now we are out of the theory, hectic theory part, and we can start with the fun. So as Stefan mentioned, we want to basically leave you with a couple of tools to expand your reserving toolkit, to gain more insights from your data. We are not here to convince you that you need to move from chain ladder to different methods for setting your reserves, but more methods can give you different insights that you wouldn't necessarily see from a chain ladder method. Just if you don't understand the reference to a bench player on the screen, in Afrikaans, a bench player is a reserve. So if you didn't catch my joke, at least you have I have your attention now. Great. So the first tool that I want to leave you with is the projected case estimate method. And I'm just going to go over it very high-levelly. This method calculates the development of case estimates and the payments on these case estimates, and we arrive at a lower triangle of payments and case estimates. For this method, we have to make two sets of selections. So firstly, we have our paid to outstanding ratios, and secondly, the case estimate development factors. So the paid to outstanding, you just calculate that by taking incremental payments in a period divided by the closing case estimate of the previous period. And case estimate development factors is the incremental payments and the closing case estimates as a proportion of the closing case estimates in the previous period. As with normal triangulation methods, there are a couple of assumptions that need to hold for this method to give reliable results. And obviously, we assume that past experience will be reflective of the future experience. If that isn't the case, data will need to be adjusted for. Great. And then when this method is more suitable is for older origin periods, where the case estimates are more accurate or at least more stable and therefore less suitable for recent origin periods where there's high IBNR proportions or where the case estimates are volatile. Okay, so jumping into the calculations, we've already spoken about the pay to outstanding factors and the case estimate development factors. So you would calculate your triangles for both of these values. You would choose your averaging method to get a selection of these so that you can get a pattern of paid to outstanding factors and a pattern of claim estimate development factors. And then lastly, you would use these patterns along with your relationship, this relationship to project your future payments and your future case estimates. So as an example, we start with pay to outstanding triangle. And you can plot this, you can gain insights, you can see how this moves over time, identify trends, even assist with identifying drivers of your results. And then we just make a selection of pattern, and we do the same for the case estimate development factors. Again, we can see trends in our data and allow for that. What we get is a lower triangle of case estimates and a lower triangle of payments. Okay, so this is quite a simple method. And if you have case reserve triangles, this is an easy method to add to your reserving toolkit. Not necessarily to select as your reserves or your ultimates, but to gain insights and to help you identify drivers. So the next method that we want to take you through is the Munich chain ladder method. Now, this method is meant to be, is aimed to be an improvement on the basic chain ladder method. So some of the same assumptions will hold. But this method was developed by Quark and Mack, and they describe it as a reserving method that reduces the gap of an IBNR projected on a paid loss versus incurred loss basis. One of the common issues we face when we're setting our reserves is that the paid chain ladder method gives different results to the incurred chain ladder method. And then the actuary is faced with the decision of applying judgment to decide which of these two methods should be selected for the final reserves. So the chain ladder tries to close that gap and make that decision easier. Now, if we look at just an example of claim developments over time, there's two things that we can clearly notice, and this is obvious in any data set, basically. Firstly, that paid and incurred claims tend towards each other over time. It's the first observation. And then the second observation is that there is a correlation between the paid and the incurred claims. So the limitation of the basic chain ladder method is that it doesn't take this correlation into account, and also the fact that incurred and paid claims tend to each other. So we see such different results in our chain ladder estimates. But the Munich chain ladder aims to take these two factors into account in producing an ultimate. Okay, so we're just going to quickly run over the calculations. So firstly, you would calculate your claim development factors as per the normal chain ladder. You'd also calculate pay to incurred ratios and incurred to paid ratios. So basically, you'll end up with four triangles, two for development factors and two for your ratios. The next step would be to calculate residuals for each of these four triangles. And lastly, we want to find a relationship between these residuals so that we can project into the future. And what this method then does is it uses the residuals and the relationship between the residuals to iteratively calculate additional diagonals of your claim development factors. And eventually you arrive at lower triangles for paid and incurred. So this example is from the paper by Quark and Mack. You can look at the paper if you want more detail. But they basically based their example on these two triangles of paid and incurred losses. The first step, as we said, is calculating the normal development factors of your claims. And secondly, the incurred to paid ratios and the paid to incurred ratios. One thing to just notice is that there's an additional diagonal for the paid to incurred and incurred to paid ratios compared to the development factors. And this will be key in the rest of the method. Okay, so this slide, just before I continue, I want to give a warning to sensitive viewers that there is quite a bit of formulae on this sheet, on this slide. So if you are sensitive, just look at the top part of the slide, please. Great. In order to calculate residuals, we first need to calculate the standard deviations and averages of our four triangles. So that is what these beautiful formulae are trying to do. And one explicit assumption for this method is that for the development factors, the last development period will only have one value. So there's no standard deviation that can be calculated, and it needs to be explicitly assumed. So, Quark and Mack have just assumed a value of 0.1. Okay, so once we have all of that beautiful mathematics, we can calculate the residuals of all four of our triangles. And something that's great about calculating residuals is you can then use these residuals to do a bootstrap method as well. But for the Munich chain ladder itself, we have the residuals. What do we do now? We want to establish a relationship so that we can project forward. And that relationship is the lambda value, as it's called by Mac and Thomas, or Thomas Mac and Quark. So if we plot the residuals of, for example, the paid development factors on x-axis and the residuals of incur-to-paid ratios on the y-axis, and we fit a regression line through the origin, so fitting a regression without a constant, then the gradient of that line will be the lambda value for paid, and similarly for incurred. And again, there is the mathematics for those that are interested. But what we get then is a relationship between the residuals, so that if you have a diagonal for one of either the residuals of the development factors or the ratios, you can calculate a diagonal for the other one. So in our case, once we have the paid and the incurred lambda, we noted before that we have an additional diagonal for the residuals of the ratios. So that leads us to calculating an additional diagonal of residuals for paid and incurred development factors. So once we have that additional diagonal, we can work back to calculate the development factors themselves, which will lead us to calculate additional diagonals of claims for incurred and paid, and we can iteratively do this process to get finally a lower triangle of paid and incurred claims. So what this method tried to achieve was to close the gap between the paid chain ladder estimates and the incurred chain ladder estimate. And we can see if we just did a normal basic chain ladder, the paid and incurred ultimates are quite different, but the Munich chain ladder has successfully closed that gap, which is what we wanted to see. Okay, and then just some of the insights that we can gain from this method is we plot the incurred to paid ratios and paid to incurred ratio developments by origin. We can also identify trends in our data, get insights on relative speeds of development relative to our average pattern that we've selected. In the last slide for the MCL, we've touched on this quite a bit. But as we said, it's meant to be an improvement to the basic chain ladder. So some of the limitations of the basic chain ladder still hold. For example, that we assume past experience to be reflective of future experience. But an additional limitation is the assumption of the linear relationship between the residuals. But then on the advantages side, we see that correlations between paid and incurred claims are taken into account. The variances of the paid and incurred claims are taken into account. We have residuals that we can do bootstrap with. The gap is closed, and we can gain insights on the speed of development of the paid and incurred claims relative to the average. That is the Munich chain ladder. It's a bit more complicated, but it's no additional data that we need for it. So, yeah, easy to just add to your reserving toolkit. Okay, so I'm going to call Stefan back up, and he is going to just give the last two tools and conclude for us.
Thanks, Laura. My favorite part were the jokes. So, okay, so just to add to that, so another method that we think is really useful is, so like in 1998, in the paper proposed that the weights for the ways to use in the standard BF method might not be most optimal when the loss development factor is less than one, so and when the loss development factor is close to one, yet when a large proportion of your incurred data consists of case estimates. Okay, so now what does that mean? So in this formula, this is the BF formula. So D is basically what your chain ladder projects, and A is like your A priori. So thinking of BF almost like Bayes statistics, where where your priori is like your prior view, and then after combining it with chain ladder, you get a posterior. Okay, so basically, what it comes down to is that if your last development factor, so that's all the chain link factors multiplied together, that thing. So when that is less than one, you are taking chain ladder and you are overestimating chain ladder. So you've got the chain ladder ultimate, and you're like basically, like say it's projecting 10,000. Now it's like the BF result is basically like 11,000. So the comment is that it's not optimal. And then also when for example working with incurred data, at a very early point in time, depending on how much your claims teams overestimate claims, but at a certain point in time, you're going to sit with potentially very early, you're going to sit with a loss development factor that's close to one. Okay, so solutions for that is to, so some call this the Gluck method, okay? So the solution is to actually, when doing an incurred BF, when you determine the credibility weights, you actually use the pattern from the paid chain ladder. And then another method is to basically rework your pattern so that whenever the pattern goes up and down and up and down, you take the absolute value instead, and then you recalculate your entire pattern. So I don't have time to go into that in depth, but that's another classic technique. Okay, so then trend adjustments. So this is a key thing. For example, what's done now in the UK with inflation, and then obviously also as soon as you're gonna start introducing monthly by monthly triangles, you're gonna sit with potentially seasonality problems in your data. So, you know, things like December periods having more theft claims and stuff like that. How do you account for that? So I'm gonna cover one method. So one technique. So it's a sort of a frequency severity approach to reserving that allows you to make really cool and customized trend like adjustments for trends. So two examples of trends we can adjust for is seasonality and inflation. But some other trends you can adjust for is like the change in mix of business over time, changing terms and conditions in your products. Average policy length, if you're like, are you reserving by underwriting period, you're just distortions in the data, and then highlight the last one, actuarial judgment, also meant to be funny. So just covering this method. So the idea is that, So with a frequency severity approach to setting your reserves, what you do is you split. Firstly, you do trend analysis differently for frequency and for severity. So you separate the two, and then so what that looks like. An example is basically to first we want to get frequency and do analysis on frequency. So that's taking your numbers triangle. So it could be like reported numbers. You divide it by exposure. So like something like your premium or something like that. Then you have a measure of frequency. And then we can apply to that sort of a trend adjustment. So what you do is you take your historic data and you divide out like almost like. Might feel a bit like thumb sucking, but you can engage your claims teams and stuff to help you understand how does my risk mix change over time to adjust your previous data to be more representative of your risk pool today. Okay, so you then divide these factors to your historic data to basically remove the update your trend in today's terms in your historic data. And then I could, for example, do a seasonality adjustment to that as well. So the adjusted data I now take, and I calculate average frequency by quarter or month for the last couple of years, and then investigate for certain trends, set an assumption about what is my seasonality trend, and then basically adjust the historic data to also remove that seasonality trend. Then I can fit a curve to my frequency assumptions. For example, I can use log linear regression fit or something like that. And then finally, on the frequency. So you basically then take your frequency and you multiply back the trends that you've removed. Okay. Then on severity side, what you can do is basically the same. So severity would be like your amounts triangle divided by numbers. And then you can also adjust that for changes in business risk mix over time. You can also adjust do a seasonality investigation on that, remove the seasonality trend. You can go and strip out inflation, and then you repeat the process for frequency, and then after you've put back the trends, and it's like your assumption of future trends, then you multiply exposure, multiply frequency by exposure by severity per origin period, and then you get an ultimate. Now, another cool thing that you can do as well is when you arrive at this, you can use that as a priori in the BF as well. So that's in very shortly and briefly, a very cool method, which is quite popular, I believe, in the UK and some other markets. Is a very nice technique that you can use to, if you have very bespoke and weird trends in your data. And it works really well because it uses the same data set that you have for Chainladder and for BF. Okay, so just concluding. The aim of this is basically just to introduce or brief you on that there are cool methods that you can introduce to expand your reserving process. And we think these ones are very practical to implement. They aren't hard to understand. They complement what we do at the moment. We think that these ones are specifically practical to the South African market. So just to add to the point I raised earlier, so since our lines of business are so predictive or so predictable, a bad projecting method isn't that bad, basically. So overseas or in other markets, there's a lot of more liability lines and weird fancy classes lines of business where there's longer tails, and then we see the chain ladder break down much sooner, basically. We think that this is maybe one of the reasons that South African reserving processes are so basic. The conclusion is that we think this is a practical next step for us, these methods. Thanks. That's it.
Thanks. That was really interesting. I think the main question I have in my mind now is, practically, just thinking from an insurer's point of view, why would they want to implement these, other methods, or increase the complexity, unless it's going to reduce their reserves and be financially beneficial? And obviously, there's no clear way to know that before you go on the whole tangent of doing the calculation. And also, most insurers will do actual versus expected. They'll be monitoring their reserves. Like you said, it's generally pretty short-term and predictable. Just want to know from your point of view, what should be the driving force for someone to want to do that?
If something were to happen where the assumption in, for example, chain ladder of basically past trends we assume to continue in future as is in your data, is if that breaks down, what do you do?
I think because of the monitoring that happens annually and the short dated nature, you know, you will raise the case estimate, you'll adjust your reserve, you will then adjust maybe to rely more on more recent periods and not so much on your further periods. So, like, I do feel like we may be more reactive, but I don't know if there's enough, like,
so
yeah, enough I, fear, I guess, maybe.
Okay.
Yeah. It, I'm not saying that these methods are not good. They look great. I'm just wondering what the drive would be. Yeah.
So what I like about that question is it's an honest question. It's like, okay, well, you know, like, what's wrong with my current approach? Okay. So what I've seen okay, so there are various benefits. For example, just that extra analysis, just that extra insights that you get. Okay. So for example, what Laura showed, like, looking at those convergence curves in the MCL, just like picking up on trends, doing actually seasonality adjustment, like a seasonality investigation, just having this set up in your reserving process gives you that insight when you need it. It saves you time, so that it's not like so that the analysis is there, so you just roll forward your process and. You can look at the metrics. It's pre-populated. It's pre-calculated. That's kind of like the philosophy. So you have a reserving process, which is, well, I think it should be mostly automated, all the calculations and streamlined, that you can just plug and play. But the thing is, if you're going to, on quarter end or year end, things have moved drastically. Now all of a sudden, your team is under so much strain to work into the nights because you need to like go and do extra analysis. So it's about like, you know, it's about if it's year end results or quarter end reserving, whatever, like, are you working late nights? Like, is that acceptable for you? Sure. but if you're proactive, if you invest in your process and you improve your process in advance, there's more to gain basically. So you can more trust your process, get insights faster. I would say that that's the main factor. Yeah, hope that answers your question. Okay.
Thanks. I think maybe a bit more of a statement, but I'd love your views. You know, if you think of a classical South African reserving example, your reserving date September, so you extract your data a couple of days after September, and you go through this whole process. You know, you've got 30, maybe 40 classes, you've got to do detailed, and maybe around November you get results. And now if we add, let's add three more methods, you probably find you'll get the results in January, in which case, why didn't we just take the values at December, because it would have been quicker. As a professional, I think we need to focus on the process. Is how can you, and you know, we can blame software providers that, oh, they don't give us, we haven't demanded it from them. How can we get the process that you can fit 16 different chain ladder methods in 4 hours? I think if you look at the data science community, what they do is, they will take a single Jupyter notebook script that downloads data, does all the transformations, gets everything there, and then you fit in XGBoost, random classifiers, decision trees, super complicated models in a couple of minutes. And you know they're able to sit there saying, I'm picking this best model out of 8. We worry on adding more methods. If we focus on the process, you'd be able to say, yeah, 16 methods, 14 of them basically give the same answer. I'm happy. Sorry, more of a statement. Like your views.
I agree. Basically, that's my day job. It's building processes. Any more questions?
Hi, thanks, Stefan. Thanks, Laura. Oh, sorry. I'm going to jump you back in there. Apparently, there was one online that I missed.
Oh, cool.
Do you see many South African insurers using machine learning in reserving? And secondly, on your slide of external factors affecting reserves, would you consider the troubles at Red Sea to be an issue setting reserves for marine books?
Okay, so maybe let me split the question. So I've not seen any insurer set reserves on machine learning. Okay, globally, I've seen it, like in the Australian market, and in the UK market, but I've not seen it in South Africa.
Thanks. And then on your slide of external factors affecting reserves, would you consider the troubles at Red Sea to be an issue setting reserves for marine books?
Ooh, I don't know. Does anyone else know the answer to that question? The troubles at the Red Sea. I don't. Yeah, it feels to me like it's a bit of a reserving practice question, which I'm, I don't know the answer.
Thanks.
Thanks, Stephen.